Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover in this audio Proverbs chapter 10. We'll call this chapter Proverbs of Solomon Part 1. It's hard to give the chapter a generic title because the Proverbs are not connected together in any logical, contextual fashion. And so as we go through the Proverbs of Solomon, we'll just say Part 1 for chapter 10, Part 2 for chapter 11, and so forth. Now, the first 9 chapters were an introduction to the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs themselves start right here in chapter 10, verse 1. And as I said, the Proverbs are separate, so one cannot analyze them together in context, as Clark and Jameson Farson Brown point out. We start with verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad. John Gill comments, as Solomon made glad his father David, for no doubt there were appearances of his wisdom before he came to the throne, though greater afterwards, which made David rejoice that he was placed on the throne before his death, to whom he had committed the charge of building the house of the Lord. You recall, right when David was about to die, he put Solomon on the throne to forestall a palace revolt. And so Solomon could be referring to himself here. A wise son makes a father like David glad. A wise son like Solomon makes a father like David glad. Here's some other Old Testament scriptures talking about how children delight their parents. Proverbs 23, verses 24 through 25, Solomon says this, "The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you." Proverbs 27:11, Solomon says, "Be wise, my son, and make my heart glad." Proverbs 23:15, "My son, if your heart is wise, my own heart will also be glad." Proverbs 17:21, Solomon says, "He who sires a fool does so to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy." That's the opposite of a son making his father's heart glad. Proverbs 17:25, Solomon says, "A foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her who bore him." Again, that's a reverse proverb, if you will. The foolish son makes a parent miserable, just like a wise son makes a parent glad. Proverbs 28:7, Solomon says, "He who keeps the law is a discerning son, but he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father." Proverbs 29:3, "A man who loves wisdom makes his father glad, but he who keeps company with harlots wastes his wealth." So Solomon notices a well-known fact of human nature that people are proud of their children, and when their children shame them, it's a terrible, terrible thing. This principle can even be applied to spiritual children. Paul says to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 through 20, "For who is our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Is it not even you, you Thessalonians, in the presence of our Lord Jesus at his coming? For you are our glory and joy." I'm assuming that that's Jesus' coming and his judgment as mentioned in Matthew 24, because the Thessalonians would have hope and joy at that time of the destruction of the persecuting Jews. And the Thessalonians are said to be a joy, a crown. Verse 20, "For you are our glory and joy." So spiritual children can make spiritual fathers very, very happy. 3 John 1, verse 4, John says this, "I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth." And of course, the converse of that is, if you've got spiritual children who are walking in darkness, it tears you up. Now, at the end of verse 1, Solomon says, "A foolish son is a grief to his mother." Why mention the mother and not the father? Why does it not say, "But a foolish son is a grief to his father and mother"? Well, all of this is meant to be understood of both parents. This is poetry. It's got to balance. It's not meant to be interpreted as separately of each. So it actually means this: a wise son makes a father and a mother glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his father and mother. It just poetically balances out if you say it the way that Solomon said it. Now here's a little literary rabbit trail. All the way through the book of Proverbs, antithetic couplets are used, which means the first part of the verse states proposition A, and the last part of the verse states proposition B, which is contrary to proposition A. But then there are also synthetic couplets when we get to Proverbs 16 and run through part of chapter 22, we will see mostly synthetic proverbs where the second line of the couplet repeats the sense of the first line, repetitious proverbs. Now, this couplet structure make the proverbs easy to memorize, and that's why you hear Christians quoting these proverbs all the time. They're very easy to remember. We go to verse 2, Proverbs 10. Solomon says, "Ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death." some options as to what ill-gotten means. It could mean that the gains were obtained immorally, or it could be that the ill-gotten gains were obtained morally but used wickedly. Either way, those gains do not profit. Think about how often money is of no use in this world. For example, how many rich people have a fatal illness? Steve Jobs, pancreatic cancer. Very, very wealthy man. He died. And we can think of other examples of men with lots and lots of money who are disgraced when they have power and they fall from power. Money can't stop it. I'm trying to think of that member of one of the Roman triumvirates who went out to the east to fight the Persians. Might not have been. I forgot who it was. But it's a great story because he was one of the wealthiest men in Rome, and they killed him by pouring molten gold down his throat to sort of make the point. Your riches aren't doing you any good. Now, not only do ill-gotten gains not profit a person who has made money that way, but often the process of getting those ill-gotten gains causes injury and death to the individual. For example, a robber might get injured or killed during the course of a robbery. So that's not only do they not profit, they actually harm you. Those ill-gotten gains do. We go now to Proverbs 10, verse 3. Solomon continues, "The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will reject the craving of the wicked." Now, this is a general statement, and it does not mean that a righteous person will never, ever hunger. What it means is that hunger will not last because God will take care of it. For example, when Jesus was being tempted, he was hungry, but then angels came and ministered to him, and he ate. We need to reconcile this statement, "The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger." We need to reconcile that with the experience of some very famous righteous men who got hungry. Paul was often in hunger and thirst. 2 Corinthians 11:27, "Labor and hardship, many sleepless nights, hunger and thirst, often without food." Hunger and thirst, often without food. How about Jacob and his sons during the famine in Egypt and the surrounding areas? Genesis 42:1-2, "When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, 'Why do you keep looking at each other? Listen,' he went on, 'I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we will live and not die.'" So Jacob and the other patriarchs, his sons, were on the verge of dying, but they didn't die. As John Gill says, they were afflicted, but they were not destroyed. So Solomon here in this proverb means that the righteous would not hunger permanently. And I'm sure this hunger is talking about physical hunger. Some people, very spiritual people, say that the Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger for spiritual riches is what Solomon meant. I don't believe that. Let's look at some scriptures about God taking care of hunger. We live on this earth, and God is perfectly willing to heal us, but in order for there to be healing, there has to be sickness. And God is perfectly willing to deliver us, but in order for there to be deliverance, there has to be persecution. God is willing to give us peace, but in order for there to be peace, there has to be war. And likewise, in order for God to fill our hunger, there has to be hunger. We are not living in heaven yet. All those things will be wiped away in heaven, but we're on this earth now. Let's look at some scriptures. Job 5:20, "In famine he will redeem you from death." This is Eliphaz speaking. Of course, Eliphaz didn't always speak the truth, but here he was. "In famine God will redeem you from death." Psalms 34:8-9, this is David. "O taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him there is no want." There's no poverty. God will take care of your poverty or your hunger. Psalms 37:16-20. "Better is the little of the righteous than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord sustains the righteous. The Lord knows the day of the blameless. The Lord knows the days of the blameless, and their inheritance will be forever. They will not be ashamed in the time of evil, and in the days of famine they will have abundance." Romans 8:35, "Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Or tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine? Or nakedness, or peril, or sword?" No, famine's not going to separate you from the love of Christ. Why? Because he's going to feed you in the famine. Hebrews 13:5, "Your life should be free from the love of money. Be satisfied with what you have, for he himself has said, 'I will never leave you or forsake you.'" You don't need to be worried about not having enough money, because God will always feed you. He will always, always feed you, and he will never, ever forsake you. So, when Solomon says the Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger in Proverbs 10:3, He was correct. But he would reject the craving of the wicked. The wicked desires money, money, money. And God said, nope, it's not going to do you any good, wicked. We go now to verse 4, Proverbs 10. Solomon continues, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand. This verse proves beyond cavil that not all poverty is caused by oppression. Some poverty is caused by laziness. Sinful behavior often leads to poverty, not only laziness, but drunkenness or gambling or whatever. There's lots of ways you can be poor by sinning. Now, this, of course, is contrary to modern secular and theological liberals who constantly say it's the system. It's rich people, like Bernie Sanders and the socialists. It's rich corporations that make everybody poor, not it's rich corporations that give people jobs. He will never say that. It's, oh, it's the rich corporations that make people poor, while he's living himself in a multi-million-dollar mansion. So, in the first part of Proverbs 10:4, we see that poverty can be brought about by negligence and laziness. But on the other hand, at the last part of verse 4, the hand of the diligent makes rich. That shows that beyond cavil that it is not a sin to be rich. This again is contrary to the thinking of modern secular and theological liberals who think that being rich is a sin. Abraham was rich. There's nothing wrong with being rich. There's nothing wrong with being poor. God decides how much money you're going to have. You need to be happy with it. Don't let your life be constrained by a love of money. He'll take care of you. But if you're very good at business, or you have a very ingenious invention that makes you rich, well, go for it. Nothing wrong with that. No use being guilty. But of course, when you get rich, you got to remember the poor. You need to give, give, give. So let's look at some other scriptures, mainly from Solomon himself. All of these, in fact, are proverbs that Solomon wrote about being lazy. Solomon did not like laziness. Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come in like a thief, and your need like an armed man. Proverbs 12, 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. Proverbs 19, 15. Laziness cast into a deep sleep, and an idle man will suffer hunger. Proverbs 19:24, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, but will not even bring it back to his mouth. And what that means is, this man is so lazy, he can put his hand to grab the food, but he's going to have somebody help him get it into his mouth. He's so lazy. Proverbs 26, verses 13 through 16, the sluggard says, there is a lion in the road, a lion is in the open square. In other words, he's not going to do anything about getting that lion out of the way. Verse 14, Proverbs 26, as the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is weary of bringing it to his mouth again. That's a repeat. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can give a discreet answer. So the sluggard is not only lazy, he's stupidly vain. Proverbs 24, verses 30 through 34. I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense. And behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles, its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it, I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Then your poverty will come as a robber, and your want like an armed man. Folks, whatever you're doing, work hard at it. I don't mean get under the law. I don't mean do it in your own flesh, because you will make yourself miserable and burn out. You do all your works through the power of Christ working in you, but don't sit around and be lazy. We go down to Proverbs 10, verse 5. Solomon says this, he who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully. As Gill says of this proverb, the sum of the proverb is that in the time of health and youth, persons should be active and industrious in their several callings and stations, and provide against a time of sickness and old age. Savings. I was talking to my son-in-law in his early 40s. I was talking about Social Security. He says, well, people our age, we don't expect to have any Social Security. We expect it to be broke. And he's probably exactly correct about that. But, of course, he's making other provisions for his old age, and that's wise. Namely, savings. Of course, it's hard to save when idiot politicians, I won't mention any names, but when they inflate the currency so that your savings become less and less valuable, it hurts you in your ability to take care of yourself in your old age. But that's life. He who gathers in summer, when you're able to work, to make hay when the sun shines, as we say. The summer is the normal time for harvest. So that gathering is talking about harvesting in an agricultural community, but he who sleeps in harvest time, of course, is shameful. We go now to Proverbs 10, verse 6. Solomon says this, "Blessings are on the head of the righteous, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence." We have a little parallel there between a head and a mouth, the head of the righteous and the mouth of the wicked. What does it mean, the mouth of the wicked conceals violence? Here's three options. First option, evil people don't protest against the violence that will be coming upon them in judgment. This is from John Gill. The mouth of the wicked conceals the fact that I'm about to get judged violently. I don't think that's the correct answer. That's just suggested by Gill. I don't think he thinks that's the correct answer either. Here's what I think is the correct option. Option number two, when the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, what the wicked is doing is hiding the violence that is really in the wicked man's heart. The mouth of the wicked conceals the violence that he has in his heart. So in other words, you better watch out for flatterers and hypocrites, because they could very well come after you violently. Option number three, the violence of the wicked shall cover their face with shame and confusion. So the proverb would read this way, but the mouth of the wicked is covered with shame and confusion by the violence of the wicked. That's not clear in the NASB translation, which says the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. But if you look at other translations, for example, the KJV, violence covereth the mouth of the wicked. So that would read this way, the violent man covers his mouth in shame. The violent man covers the mouth of the wicked in shame. The NIV has violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked, which would mean the violent man has his mouth covered in shame. That to me is hard to even talk about here as I try to explain it, so I don't think that's the correct option. I think simply it means that evil people hide the violence that is really in their heart when Solomon says the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Moving now to the next verse, Proverbs 10:7, we read this, "The memory of the righteous is blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot." Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that rot literally means to be worm-eaten. Well, how is the name of the wicked worm-eaten? Two options. Option number one, the name of the wicked will be buried in oblivion. Everyone will forget the wicked. Here's some other examples of this. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 8:10, "So then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten. Forgotten in the city where they did thus. This too is futility." Psalms 49 verses 10 through 12, written by the sons of Korah. "For one can see that wise men die, foolish and stupid men also pass away. Then they leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their eternal homes, from generation to generation, though they have named estates after themselves. But despite his assets, man will not last. He is like the animals that perish." That psalm mainly emphasizes the fact that the wicked can't take it with them when they go, but it also implies that people will forget this man and his riches when he's gone. And that's absolutely true. Solomon's father David said in Psalms 9:6, "The enemy has come to an end in perpetual ruins, and you have uprooted the cities. The very memory of them has perished." Well, that's one option as to how the name of the wicked will rot. Another option is the wicked will be remembered, not forgotten, as in option one. The wicked will be remembered, but infamously remembered. For example, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong. Yeah, we remember those guys, but not in a good way. And actually, the answer as to how the wicked will rot could be both. They will rot in oblivion or they will rot in infamy, depending on who the wicked are. The wicked who are not so famous will be forgotten, and the wicked who are famous will be remembered for all the wrong reasons. We go now to Proverbs 10, verse 8. Solomon continues, "The wise of heart will receive commands, but a babbling fool will be ruined." Now, these commands, of course, are just commands. Solomon just assumes that. We're not supposed to receive commands that are not just. For example, if a wife is commanded by her husband to go star in a pornographic film, the husband should be confronted with a gun pointed between his eyes, the trigger of which is being caressed by his wife. The wise of heart will receive commands from parents, from bosses, from the government, of course. You want to be submissive in all your daily activities and not arrogant, assuming the commands are just. But a babbling fool will be ruined. Fools usually reveal how stupid they are by talking too much. Often they babble about their authority. In other words, they complain about who's over them. This violates a good rule of management, by the way. You should never say anything bad about your boss to your coworkers. Never, ever don't do it. But of course, people do it all the time. And if it gets back to their boss, that worker is in a world of trouble. We're going to see just two verses later in Proverbs 10:10 that he who winks the eye causes trouble and a babbling fool will be ruined. People who babble too much are fools. We go now to Proverbs 10:9. Solomon continues, he who walks in integrity walks securely, but he who perverts his ways will be found out. Similar verse, Solomon writes in Proverbs 28:18, he who walks blamelessly will be delivered, but he who is crooked will fall all at once. In Proverbs 10:9, the man walking in a perverted way will be found out. He will be discovered in his wickedness that he's trying to hide. If not in this life, at least in the world to come, as John Gill points out. Whereas Proverbs 28:18 says that the wicked will be tripped up. He'll fall. He'll be found out in Proverbs 10:9 and Proverbs 28:18. The wicked will fall. We go down to Proverbs 10:10. Solomon says, he who winks the eye causes trouble, and a babbling fool will be ruined. Winking the eye is mentioned by Solomon in Proverbs 6:13, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his fingers. Now, what this refers to is the act of sending secret signals to your evil comrades while you are dealing with a target. You've seen that in movies, I'm sure. It happens all the time. Now we have the babbling fool here. Again, in verse 10, he'll be ruined, just as he was to be ruined in verse 8. The Septuagint translation has this second clause differently. Instead of a babbling fool will be ruined, the Septuagint has, he that reproveth with freedom maketh peace, which is not exactly the same thing. The idea behind this translation is that dealing with sin leads to more peace as opposed to just letting the sin go. So you reprove. Get rid of the sin and you make peace, if that be the correct translation. Now notice that in the first part of verse 10, we have winking the eye, which means being too quiet about one's heart, not telling your target, the person you're dealing with, what's really on your heart because you're winking with your comrade. But on the other hand, in contrast to that, the second part of verse 10 talks about somebody who's talking too much, babbling. Go now to Proverbs 10:11. Solomon continues, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Now, the second part of Proverbs 10:11, the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, we've already discussed in Proverbs 10:6, and I won't go over that again. I will say what John Gill says of this, quote, nothing comes out of it, this mouth, the mouth of the wicked, nothing comes out of it but what is pernicious and hurtful, what savors of rapine and violence. Nothing but lying and deceit, cursing and swearing, and such like filthy and corrupt communication. Contrast that with the mouth of the righteous. Gill says that refers to a fountain of life that comes out of the mouth of the righteous. He states it this way, like a fountain of living water, continually running and flowing with water, wholesome, reviving, and refreshing. So the righteous man's mouth, out of the abundance of his heart, overflows with good things, which minister grace to the hearers, and are for the use of edifying, things that are pleasant and profitable, grateful and acceptable, comforting, refreshing, and pleasing, and which tend to the good of the life that now is, and that which is to come. We go now to Proverbs 10:12. Solomon says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. Gill says of stirring up strife, hatred will stir up or awake, as the word signifies, contentions and quarrels which were happily laid asleep. These he renews by tale-bearing, the wicked man does, and whisperings and evil surmises by raising lies, spreading false reports and calumnies, and by virulent reproaches and slanders. Love covers all transgressions, not one's own transgressions, of course. Those should be confessed, not covered up. It also doesn't mean that Christians shouldn't properly rebuke and reprove the sins of other Christians? Of course not. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. That's not what it means. What it means is that love forgives all transgressions. As Gill puts it, love spreads its mantle over the sins of its fellow creatures and Christians and forgives them, even all of them, instead of exposing them, hides and conceals them, and instead of loading and aggravating the infirmities of others, puts the best constructions on them, hopes and bears, and believes all things. There's one thing that I have learned after being alive for 71 years and being a Christian for about 60 of those years, is that human beings are very flawed, including Christians. And if you want to go around finding faults, both in yourself and in other people, it's real easy to do. But at some point, you just got to quit doing that, cover it over, and say, I forgive them. They're not perfect. That's the way they are. They're not perfect. They will be perfect one day when they're glorified, but I am not watching them now while they're glorified, so I'm just going to live with their imperfections. That doesn't mean you tolerate gross sin. Of course not. But at least with the foibles of human nature, you have to put up with that. 1 Peter 4:8 in the New Testament, Peter says, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. So if you're really loving your Christian brother, you are going to see a multitude of sins. And Peter knows that, and he expects the Christian to cover over those sins and forgive those sins and tolerate those sins and bear with those sins. We go down to Proverbs 10:13. Solomon continues, wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of the one who lacks sense. Now, the Septuagint translates this verse this way. He that brings forth wisdom out of his lips smites with a rod him that is void of understanding. In other words, the Septuagint has the wicked person being whipped by the wise person. But the Holman Christian Study Bible does not, and I think most of the translations don't do it that way. They just say a rod is for the back of the one who lacks sense, leaving it indeterminate as to who is wielding the rod. Adam Clark says the rod is a most powerful instrument of knowledge. That's why I believe in giving exams to college students. I remember law exams, worst rod I've ever been smited with or smitten with, whatever the word is. But I would not have learned the law if I did not have the terror of those exams facing me. We go to Proverbs 10:14. Solomon continues, wise men store up knowledge, but with the mouth of the foolish, ruin is at hand. So storing up is for the future, ruin is at hand is in the present. Foolish people talk, and they're instantly ruined, whereas wise men, they don't talk, they just become wiser and wiser and wiser because they're storing up knowledge. The mouth of the foolish, Solomon refers to, how many times in Proverbs is talking too much connected with foolishness? Let me give you some examples, and then I'll finish with a famous passage from James. Proverbs 10:10, we just read that. He who winks the eye causes grief, and a babbling fool will be ruined. Foolish lips, the Holman Christian Study Bible has. Proverbs 12:14, a man will be satisfied with good by the fruit of his words. Proverbs 13:2-3, from the fruit of a man's mouth he enjoys good, but the desire of the treacherous is violence. The one who guards his mouth preserves his life. The one who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. Proverbs 21:23, he who guards his mouth and his tongue guards his soul from troubles. Folks, that's the Old Testament telling you to keep your mouth shut. Here's the New Testament, James 3:6-10. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body, and sets on fire the course of our life, and is set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea, is tamed. It has been tamed by the human race, but no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father. And with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come both blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. Those of you who say, well, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me, you have not read the Bible or experienced life, because there is nothing worse than a slanderous, lying, poisonous, evil tongue. Now, in the first part of verse 14, Proverbs 10, wise men store up knowledge. That idea of storing up, within it is an idea of concealing or hiding. As Adam Clark says, wise men keep secret everything that has a tendency to disturb domestic or public peace. But the foolish man blabs all out and produces much mischief. Think much, speak little, and always think before you speak. We go down to Proverbs 10:15. Solomon continues, the rich man's wealth is his fortress. The ruin of the poor is their poverty. Now, in the first part of this verse, the rich man's wealth is his fortune, we have two optional ways to interpret it. We could interpret it straightforwardly and say, yes, it is true, objectively, that if a man has a lot of wealth, he has a lot of protection. As John Gill says, he can defend himself from the injuries of others and support himself and family in times of public calamity, for money is a defense and answers all things. Well, if that's the way we take it, then this shows that, once again, not all riches are sinful, as I pointed out in a previous proverb. Riches gained by unrighteous methods. Now, those are ill-gotten gains and, of course, are to be condemned. But there's nothing wrong with wealth in general, so we could take it that way. But we could also take it another way. We could say the rich man's wealth is his fortress, but only in his mind, in his deceived mind. Here's what John Gill says about that. His wealth is so in his own apprehension and conceit. He puts his trust and confidence in it and thinks himself safe and secure by it. When he is trusting to uncertain riches, which will fail him, these may fly away from him in life and leave him exposed to distress and danger, and however will not secure him at death from the wrath of God and everlasting destruction. Or he is lifted up with his riches, is in high spirits, and despises others, thinking himself safe as in a strong castle, and fears nothing, distresses, diseases, or death. Proverbs 18:11 expresses this well. Solomon says, a rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his own imagination. There's where his wealth is, or there's where his defense is, his high wall. It's in his own head, in his own imagination. Well, I'm not sure which way to go on that. I tend to think that Solomon is speaking straightforwardly here. The rich man's wealth is his fortress because, let's face it, rich people, they can hire the best lawyers. They can hire the best doctors. And poor people can't do that. And so I think Solomon is just observing a fact of life. However, if the idea that the rich man's wealth is only in his mind, we could refer to the example of Kanye West, yeah, as he now calls himself, who has totally destroyed himself with his anti-Semitic nonsense, posting a Twitter account with a Nazi swastika embedded in a Jewish flag, the flag of Israel. He's basically crazy. He professed Christ. Then he's lost his wife. He's lost his family. Last I heard, his wealth had dropped from $1.4 billion down to $400 million, and it's still sinking, I'm assuming, as we speak. He's gotten into Black Hebrew Israelism, which is a racist, anti-Semitic cult. Well, he might think that his $1.4 billion was going to protect him, but it hasn't. He's ruined himself. Now, let's look at two other scriptures that Solomon wrote about wealth in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 7:12. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. Well, there Solomon's speaking straight. He admits that money is protection. But then we read in Ecclesiastes 10:19, Solomon says this, men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Well, I'm sure Solomon is being sarcastic there. He knows that money is not the answer to everything. He's talking about the futility of life, all its vanity and striving after the wind, preparing meals and wine and woo, and it doesn't mean a thing to him. Now, he had all that. So I guess we can summarize this. I don't know exactly what Solomon is saying, but it is true that a man's wealth helps him out somewhat temporally, but ultimately it does not protect him from the ruin that's coming upon his head. Now, in the last part of verse 15, Solomon says, the ruin of the poor is their poverty. This verse seems to cut against the monastic notion of poverty as a blessing and a virtue, because poverty is said to be ruin here. Think about all those medieval vows of poverty. I've always thought that's absolute nonsense. Why would you want to bring a curse on yourself? In Deuteronomy 28, poverty was a curse for not keeping the law. And so here, these monks in the Middle Ages are saying, curse me, God. I'm taking a vow of curse. I'm taking a vow to curse me. I'm taking a vow of poverty. No wonder the Reformation rebelled against this ridiculous idea. We go now to Proverbs 10, verse 16. Solomon continues, the wages of the righteous is life, the income of the wicked, punishment. Now, if we take this verse too absolutely, we have a problem. The wages of the righteous is life. The martyrs in Hebrews 11, they were righteous, but they didn't get life. They got killed. Now, how do you get around that? Well, there's a couple ways. You can soften it with the translation, as the KJV does. King James has, the labor of the righteous tendeth to life. Tendeth is in italics, not in the original text. The KJV translators added that. The wages of the righteous leads to life, or it inclines one to life. It's not an absolute guarantee. Well, that's one way to handle it, and I think that's probably the best way to handle it. Another way is to say, well, the wages of the righteous is eternal life, which includes life in the next life. And that's absolutely true. You don't have to fudge that at all. We go down to Proverbs 10:17. Solomon continues, he is on the path of life who heeds instruction, but he who ignores reproof goes astray. Notice how Solomon's emphasizing life here. Verse 17, life. Verse 16, the wages of the righteous is life as opposed to death. Now that life could be eternal life. It could be temporal life. It could be both. I don't know what was in Solomon's mind, but the point is, it's true. You listen to the instruction of God. Well, Solomon's talking about the instruction of a father to a son, but he's very confident in his instruction. He knows that it will lead his son to life. We listen to the instruction of our Heavenly Father, we're going to get life and not death. Proverbs 10:18, he who conceals hatred has lying lips, and he who spreads slander is a fool. The first person who conceals hatred is a hypocrite who hates you, and he lies to you, and he says, oh, you're such a great person, while he's getting ready to stab you in the back. So that's a secret hatred. Here's a open hatred that's expressed in the second part of verse 18. He who spreads slander, he hates you openly, brooding it about to the public that you are a bad person. More sins of words. This would be an interesting study. How many sins in Proverbs have to do with words? I've already talked about sins with words 4 verses ago when we were on Proverbs 10:14. I'll read that one again. The wise stores up knowledge, but the mouth of the fool hastens destruction. And I mentioned a whole other bunch of verses about words destroying you. Won't do it again. We go now to verse 19 of Proverbs 10. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. Well, here's an example of the Proverbs I was just telling you about how Solomon hates loose lips. Let me read you a couple here. Psalms 39, verse 1. This is a psalm written by David. I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. Keep your mouth shut. Now, sometimes you have to reprove. Sometimes you have to be bold. Sometimes you have to witness. I understand that. But generally, if there's something evil going down and you don't know what to say or how to say it or when to say it, just keep your mouth shut. Don't pop off. James 1:26, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Keep your mouth shut until God tells you to open it. Proverbs 10:20, Solomon says, the tongue of the righteous is as choice silver. Ah, here's another verse about words. The tongue of the righteous is as choice silver. The heart of the wicked is worth little. Even the little external organ of the righteous, the tongue, is better than the whole heart of the wicked. A good heart produces righteous speech. The heart and the tongue, of course, are connected together. Proverbs 10:21, Solomon continues. Ah, once more, another proverb about words. The lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of understanding. Some examples of what righteous lips might speak, words of encouragement, prayers. Fools die for lack of understanding. Is that spiritual death? Sure. Premature physical death? Possibly. We move now to Proverbs 10, verse 22. Solomon says this, it is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it. Now notice again, rich, if that includes material riches, and of course I believe it does, then that means that riches are not per se sinful, like many leftists and liberals like to say. Nothing wrong with being rich. It's the blessing of the Lord that makes rich. And by the way, these verses are good for people like yours truly who have guilt complexes and think, oh gosh, there's all this poverty in Africa and poverty everywhere, and I'm sitting here, God's taking care of all my needs. I don't have to worry about food, and I start feeling guilty about it. Well, I shouldn't, because it is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich. I attribute everything that I put in my mouth or every scrap of cloth that I put on my back, I attribute it to my Lord who is taking care of me, as in the Sermon on the Mount. It's the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, not my own industry, diligence, or sagacity. Now, it is true, of course, that working hard has a part to play in the acquisition of wealth. For example, Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Yes, you have to work. I'm not being super spiritual here, but behind all of my or anybody else's hard work is the Lord who makes rich. And of course, the Lord also makes one rich spiritually too, but I don't think that's what Solomon's talking about here. In the last part of verse 22, God adds no sorrow to the riches that are gotten from the blessing of the Lord. This phrase is added to distinguish wealth gotten by the ungodly or by wealth gotten by ungodly means. In other words, If you're making money by being productive, taking care of your employees, giving money to the poor, etc., 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 supporting the work of the gospel, that's a blessing. There's no sorrow in that, but if you go out just to get rich so you can be rich and have a big boat and big car and big airplane and all that, there's going to be sorrow added to your riches. Sorrow, anxiety, and distress. Ecclesiastes 2, verses 21 through 23, Solomon says this, "When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This, too, is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This, too, is vanity." So there's someone who works and works and works and works to get rich, and it's all vanity. 1 Timothy 6, verses 9 through 10, Paul tells Timothy, "But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." You want to pierce yourself with a lot of grief? You want to add sorrow to the blessing of the Lord, who provides all your material needs, but you got to go out and you got to get rich because that's all you care about? Are you listening, cash flow dollar? Are you listening, all you Copenhagenites? Are you listening? You want to do that? You're going to end up with nothing but sorrow. You won't be wealthy. You'll be poor. You might have a fat bank account, but your life will be stricken with utter and extreme poverty. You will be pierced with many griefs. You will be plunged into ruin and destruction. You will be trapped by temptation and a snare. 1 Timothy 6:17, Paul says to Timothy, "Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited." He didn't say get rid of the money. The blessing of the Lord, it maketh rich. There's nothing wrong with having money, nothing wrong with being rich. But they should be instructed not to be conceited. Oh, I'm a big shot because I made a bunch of money. Not to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. You hope in riches, they'll go. Like I just said, Kanye West has lost $1.4 billion down to $400 million. That is $1 billion in the space of about 2 weeks. $1 billion. Rich people need to focus on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So God will give you everything you need, and you need to enjoy them. And don't feel guilty about it. Don't let the social justice warriors and the left-wing nut jobs who are now infiltrating the Church of Jesus Christ, don't let them make you feel guilty about the riches you might have. But on the other hand, don't let the prosperity gospel nitwits act like the aim in life is to have a $23 million mansion. I remember I was in the car with one of these prosperity advocates, and he says, "You know, there's so many people out there that just focus on $1 billion, but I'm going to use the laws of attraction. I'm supporting the idea that I am going to get $1 trillion. I'm aiming at being a trillionaire." Well, I don't even know if there's any such thing as a trillionaire on this earth. And I remember looking at this guy and I'm thinking, this guy is crazy. He ended up in jail, by the way. Spent 5 years in the federal slammer, financial fraud. Proverbs 10:23, Solomon continues, "Doing wickedness is like sport to a fool, and so is wisdom to a man of understanding." Sport is fun. I love sports, actually. I have to fight an addiction to sports. Well, wicked people, that's their sport, doing evil. Likewise, wise people, that's their sport, being wise. The NIV translates this as a fool finds pleasure in evil conduct, just like sports fans find pleasure in watching a sporting event. We go down to Proverbs 10, verse 24. Solomon continues, "What the wicked fears will come upon him, but the desire of the righteous will be granted." Now, wicked people normally do not have peace of mind. They're worried about a fellow crook hoodooing them, maybe even killing them. Wicked people instinctively know that their evil brings about evil that might do them in. "But the desire of the righteous will be granted." Again, assuming your desires are planted on what God wants, those are righteous desires, and God will give it to you. He loves to give good gifts to his children. Some of the desires of the righteous might include righteousness itself. A righteous person wants to be more righteous, wants to learn more of God, and God will say, "Yeah, I'll give you that desire." Could be temporal things too, what is needed to support life and vocation, not something to make you filthy rich. The desire of the righteous might be eternal life in heaven. Whatever it is, God's going to give it to you. He loves to give good gifts to his children. Now notice in the first part of the verse, "what the wicked fears will come upon him." That verse has been misused by the Copenhagenites, the parody gospel, the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, confess it and possess it, scream it and redeem it, mark it and park it, folks. And they say, you're hung by your tongue. You said something, you're afraid of something, and it comes upon you. But notice how this distorts this verse. The Copenhagenites are saying, what righteous Christians fear will come upon them. This verse says, what the wicked fears will come upon him because of his wickedness. But a Christian is not wicked, and so he doesn't need to worry about something coming on his head. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of a sound mind, as the Apostle Paul says. We go now to verse 25, Proverbs 10. Solomon continues, when the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Now note, the whirlwind passes over the righteous as well as the wicked. So the wicked and the righteous have to go through the same stuff, like if a hurricane comes. But the difference is, the wicked gets wiped out by it. The righteous, because they are planted upon the rock of Jesus Christ, they have an everlasting foundation. Everlasting means it ain't going down. What did Jesus say? When the winds come, the floods come, the one who's built his house upon a rock will stand. John Gill says the whirlwind passing by is the wicked himself coming on the righteous, and then the wicked is done away with. I don't think so. I just think he's talking about the vicissitudes of life. The righteous has an everlasting foundation because his life is based on an everlasting covenant. We go now to Proverbs 10, verse 26. Solomon says, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the lazy one to those who send him. This is referring to a principal sending a dilatory messenger to do something. He's lazy. He's slow. Proverbs 26, 6. He cuts off his own feet and drinks violence who sends a message by the hand of a fool. The general principle expressed by this proverb, when you tell someone that you're going to do something, do it quickly. Don't mess around. Vinegar to the teeth tastes awful. I used to drink vinegar drinks in China, but they were very diluted, and after a while it got to be very good. But you drink vinegar straight, ooh, it'll make your teeth shed their enamel. Smoke to the eyes is very irritating. It's irritating to send a lazy one out. It's irritating to a principal to have a lazy agent. The next proverb is Proverbs 10:27. Solomon continues, the fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Now, life is not going to be prolonged beyond the unalterable purposes and decrees of God, of course. Job 14:5 says this, since his days are determined, the number of his months is with you, God, and his limits you, God, have set so that he, man, cannot pass. That's Job speaking, and of course he's absolutely correct. So when Solomon says that the fear of the Lord will prolong life, he just means as a general rule, life will be relatively longer than other human beings who don't fear the Lord. The years of the wicked will be shortened. And of course, as I've said earlier, this is a general rule. The martyrs of Hebrews 11 had their lives shortened, and Jesus was killed around 30, and he feared Yahweh. There are lots of scriptures that promise long life in obeying God. Exodus 20:12, honor your father and mother so that you may have long life. Deuteronomy 5:33, follow the whole instruction of the Lord, and you have a long life in the land. Deuteronomy 30:19, choose life. Psalms 21:4, God's king asked life of God the Father, and God gave it to him, length of days. As David said, Psalms 91:16, the author of which is unknown, with a long life I will satisfy the godly saint. Proverbs 3:16, long life is in wisdom's right hand. Proverbs 4:10, listen, my son, accept my words, and you will live many years. The last part of the verse says, the years of the wicked will be shortened. That's the natural result of riotous living, diseases, STDs, injuries and bar fights, punishment from the civil magistrates, get thrown in jail, get homosexually raped because you did something illegal. Psalms 55:23. David says this, but you, O God, will bring them down to the pit of destruction. Men of bloodshed and deceit will not live out half their days. That's true, generally true. Ecclesiastes 7:17, do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? The fear of death, a premature death, should be a remarkable incentive to one to listen at least to wisdom, if not to the righteousness of God, at least to common sense wisdom. We go down to Proverbs 10:28. Solomon continues, the hope of the righteous is gladness, but the expectation of the wicked perishes. Here's some hope scriptures. Paul says to the Romans in Romans 5:2, through whom also we have obtained our introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we exult in hope of the glory of God, in hope of seeing God's glory. Hebrews 3:6, but Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Hope is the confident expectation of the future, which we cannot see, but we expect there to be a good future. The expectation of the wicked perishes, Solomon says in Proverbs 10:28. The wicked have no expectation of pleasure in this world or the next, because money and fame don't bring gladness. Bildad says to Job in Job 8:13, so are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the godless will perish. And Bildad, in this case, was exactly right. We go now to Proverbs 10:29. The way of the Lord is a stronghold to the upright, but ruin to the workers of iniquity. Now, the way this verse reads in the NASB translation and the NIV also is that the way of the Lord is a ruin to workers of iniquity. Well, why would a worker of iniquity be walking in the way of the Lord? And if he were walking in the way of the Lord, why would he experience ruin? Well, this is a translation issue. If we translate Proverbs 10:29 as the KJV does, we end up with this. The way of the Lord is strength to the upright, but destruction shall be to the workers of iniquity. Not the way of the Lord is destruction to the workers of iniquity, but destruction shall be. The KJV italicizes shall be because those words are not in the original text. So that's one way to solve it with that translation. Another way is just to take the way of the Lord as simply the Lord. The Lord is a stronghold to the upright. The Lord is ruin to the workers of iniquity. If we look at the New American Bible translation of Proverbs 10:29, we see this. The Lord is a stronghold to him who walks honestly, but to evildoers, their downfall. So it's just a translation problem. Stronghold means a strong defense, but on the other hand, evil people are ruined. That ruin could either be eternal ruin or temporal ruin, or perhaps both. Or I should say, definitely both, unless they repent. We go now to Proverbs 10:30. Solomon continues, the righteous will never be shaken, but the wicked will not dwell in the land. Now the righteous might be moved from place to place, because Christians have no continuing city. Exile often happens to the righteous. That might be true, but they'll never be shaken from their faith. The wicked will not dwell in the land. The wicked will not inherit the earth. The righteous will inherit the earth, or will inherit the land. Let's read some passages out of Psalm 37, written by David. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Verse 11, Psalm 37, but the humble will inherit the land. Psalms 37:22, for those blessed by him will inherit the land. Psalms 37:29, the righteous will inherit the land. And then, of course, the very famous passage in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, the earth there, of course, is gay, and that could be land. The Greek is gay. I want to read you an interesting marginal note from the Darby translation. He translates it as earth. The meek shall inherit the earth. And then he says in his marginal note, or land. This is a quotation from Psalm 37:11. For a Jew inheriting the land was inheriting the earth, and vice versa. It was not the haughty Pharisee or the violent who were to have it. God would give it to the meek of the earth that waited on him. I have put earth as giving a larger thought, as characteristic, not local only. Here, gay in Greek agrees with eretz in Hebrew, or land. So, whether it's a Jew inheriting the land or the Christian inheriting the earth, the idea is the same because the promised land is a type of the kingdom of God and whatever that entails, and I assume it entails inheriting this physical planet that God created for us. We go now to Proverbs 10:31. Solomon continues, the mouth of the righteous flows with wisdom, but the perverted tongue will be cut out. The mouth of the righteous flows, the literal Hebrew there is germinates. The mouth of the righteous germinates with wisdom. A righteous mouth grows fruit. Once more, a proverb dealing with words, speaking. But the perverted tongue will be cut out. That probably alludes to the punishment of cutting out the tongue for blasphemy, which I don't know if the Jews did that or not. Somebody has done that. We move now to the last verse in Proverbs 10. The lips of the righteous bring forth what is acceptable, but the mouth of the wicked what is perverted. One more admonition against foolish talk. We'll leave it at that. We've now finished Proverbs 10 and are now ready to go to Proverbs 11, which we will call the Proverbs of Solomon Part 2. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.